Here is one of a series of talks by spiritual leader Lola McDowell Lee, spanning two decades from the early 70s through the 90s. Lola was a Zen Roshi whose Rinzai lineage included Dr. Henry Plutov and renowned Zen master Shigetsu Sasaki. Lola was a religious scholar as well as an ordained Christian minister. While the talks are focused mainly on Zen and Buddhism, Lola drew on many spiritual traditions, including those of Jesus, Plato, Lao Tzu, the Hindu Vedas, Meister Eckhart, and Gurdjieff.
Like an archer fashions an arrow, the wise man steadies his trembling mind, a fickle and restless weapon. Flapping like a fish thrown on dry ground, it trembles all day, struggling to escape from the snares of Mara the temptress. The mind is restless. To control it is good. A disciplined mind is the road to nirvana. Look to your mind, wise man. Look to it well. It is subtle, invisible, treacherous. A disciplined mind is the road to nirvana. Swift, single, nebulous. It sits in the cave of the heart. Who conquers it frees himself from slavery. Okay, that's from the Dhammapada. Now, Buddhism, and of course the traditional Zen, revolves around Gautama's enlightenment experience, the enlightenment experience, whereupon he was given the name of the Buddha, and which word means enlightened one. You know, enlightenment is a bodhi, and bodhi is a word for wisdom. So he sat under the bodhi tree. Buddha and the bodhi are from the same root, bud, B-U-D-H, which means to wake, to become aware of, to know. Yeah. So a Buddha is an awakened one. He has awakened from a life of relativity, you know, black and white, up and down, near and far. awakened from his conditioning. And the doctrine that he taught is based on his enlightenment. And the purpose of his teaching at all was to help every one of us to attain this same state of enlightenment, which is called Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi, which means the perfect enlightenment that knows no equal. Jesus came with a mission. I mean, his enlightenment was foreordained. You know, he was to set the example. He lived the example of his birth and his crucifixion and his resurrection. The Buddha rose out of the ranks of humanity and became enlightened through his own efforts. Now, the teachings, both of Buddha and Jesus, should not remain as, it's not supposed to remain as something which stands outside of us, such as something that we might study, like we study the law, we study mathematics, we study history, and so on. Not with this kind of a teaching. And Buddha very strongly urged his followers, those in the Sangha, in the brotherhood, the group of monks that lived there with him, and the lay students, which were near and far, his admonition was, value your own personal experience. That's what you value. You do not need to rely on authority for experience. You're not even on the Buddha himself, nor to anyone you think is a superior personality. You cannot rely on another to get you into heaven. You cannot. And he urged everyone to exert himself for his own emancipation, for his own freedom, for his own liberation. Now, what these monks and these lay people were seeking, and what he was trying to guide them to, was freedom. Freedom from the relative, freedom from the conditioning. And we read in this Dhammapada, by oneself, indeed, is evil done. By oneself is one injured. By oneself is evil left undone. By oneself is one purified. Purity and impurity belong to oneself. No one can purify another. That's how it begins, this Dhammapada. The Dhammapada, which is the teaching of the Dharma, it's a Theravadan thing, the little vehicle, where they use the word Dhamma. In Mahayana Buddhism, the large or the great vehicle, they say Dharma. So in Ceylon, Sri Lanka now, isn't it, you will find the word Dhamma. And in India and in Japan, you find the word Dharma, Mahayana Buddhism, Dharma. The teaching of the Dharma. And he said, I will teach you the Dharma. Here is a Dharma. If this is, that also is. If this is not, that also is not. When this stops also. This is the law. This is the Dharma. Sounds pretty simple, huh? Yeah. Now, to take upon oneself, now, you're going to put your shoulders under this thing, to take upon oneself one's own liberation is not the way we usually think of it in the Western world. In our culture, we depend on Jesus, or we depend on some priest, or we depend on a minister, and we say, pray for us, save us, and so on and so on. Save us a place in heaven. You're going to sit at, at the right hand down a few spaces from God, but let us also have a few spaces in there too for me. Save me, Yeah. Now comes this admonition, I must do for myself. Too rigorous, say some. makes me take too much responsibility. Say some. Too disciplined. Say some. Too hard. Say some. Where should I even start? My God, look at me. Where am I going to begin? Very simple. You start where you are. Everybody starts where they are. You start with what you are. But begin. You know, commence. Let's get the show on the road. After all, you know, it's not such a silly way of looking at things. You've got to drink your own water when you're thirsty. You can't get anybody else to do that for you. You cannot get a proxy to do your work in heaven or to do your work in hell. No. You've got to do that yourself, huh? You can't get anyone to come to this class on a Sunday morning for you and then tell you what occurred. After all, 5 minutes after you're out of here, you don't even remember what I said. Huh? And besides, if somebody's going to tell you, it's their interpretation of what I said. And that isn't going to help you very much, I don't think. You can't get anyone to come and sit for meditation for you and then tell you what occurred. You fall in love. You can't get somebody else to come and live in that relationship for you. No. You can think of all kinds of things. You've got to do your own eating. You've got to do your own bathing. You've got to do your own walking. You even have to go to the bathroom for yourself. Yeah? So, enlightenment is a personal experience. So, let's find out a little bit about this enlightenment. By our own experience. If it's not your experience, it is simply not yours. I don't care how many Buddhas are running around out there. You know, there could be 10,000. What good does it do you? The experience is what counts. Yeah. So here and there, you know, far between here and there, you know, an individual makes up his mind. Enlightenment is what he wants. You know, and there is in him maybe a need for it. And he has a hunger for it, like you have a hunger for a certain kind of food. Now, if he hungers enough, that very hunger will lead him out of the morass of desire and delusion. The deluded mind. Which is not very far away. cannot lead you to enlightenment. When you can step away from, disidentify yourself, step away from the thinking mind, and you have looked at this thinking from another point of view, until you do that, not you, of course, people in general, until that occurs, we do not know how deluded this mind really is. Yeah. And the only thing, so when you sit down, you know, you say to yourself, well, I have a deluded mind. I admit it. You know, it won't hurt. I have a deluded mind. What am I going to do with a deluded mind? Now with my meditation. The only thing you can do with a deluded mind is to forget it for the time being. Just through your meditation period. That's not long. Just forget it for now. And then, of course, you have your daily practice where you practice being aware. And you can see through that how deluded the mind is. And now, people often ask, and they do wonder, how did this man whom we have come to call the Buddha, how did he achieve his enlightenment? I mean, what did he do? Methods did he use? And so on, because after all, if he did it, if I can find out how he did it, why then, here I come, folks. It's a big question. How did he achieve his enlightenment? Well, when he started his search, he was about 18. He was married. He had a child. He was married when he was 16. Remember, this is 2,500 years ago, and conditions were a little different, and particularly there in India. And he was brought up in this palace, and his father saw to it that he saw nothing but beauty. Dancing girls, beautiful clothes, beautiful horses. When he went out beyond the palace gates, the streets were swept, and everything was arranged, so he saw nothing but beauty. And then he decided one day that he would start looking at things on his own. So he got this attendant of his to take him outside the palace walls early in the morning. And there were four gates to this palace, in the wall. And he went out one gate one morning and he saw something that horrified him. And the next day he went out another gate and he saw something else that horrified him. For the first time in his life, he came across poverty and illness and death. And it was the last one where somebody had died and was lying there on the ground. And this upset him more than all the rest. So his concern then became how to be free of life and death. And he, as we know, he left the palace and went on his search. And he was about 40 because he lived to be 80. And he taught for 40 years, if I remember correctly. It'd make him about 40, wouldn't it? Or did he teach for 49 years? That would make him 30. So he was 30, 18 to 30. It took him. That's not bad. He wanted to know what death was. Then he would be free of it. If it remained just something very nebulous in his mind that was happening to people, he wouldn't know any more about it than if you read about it in a book. And he wanted to be free of the conditioning. He wanted to be free of this relativity. The content of the psyche, our conditioning, it binds us. And of course, it's different things for different people. But it is binding. We have these habit patterns that are based on we don't know what, because we don't look. And so this bondage. And with bondage, what have you got? Tension. And this is the situation that human beings find themselves in. Now, there is something in all of us that reflects, ponders about existence. Maybe a little bit shallow, maybe pretty deep, but something in us does reflect the way we find this world. out of our conditioning, out of the situation in which we stand, we begin to long for a different kind of a world where there is only peace, where there's enough to eat, where all the good things are, and in which we will live forever. So we begin to long for this immortality, you know, and we're told that there is such a place. Let me know when you find it. We want absolute freedom. Yeah. To be free of the things that bind us. To be free of our identifications. We want to become conscious inwardly, that is, subjectively, as well as outwardly, objectively. We have this subject-object existence. We have an ability to probe into the significance of things. We have this ability to probe and see if it has any meaning. Of course, we should always, say too, what meaning does it have for me? Because you cannot give a chair a meaning and say that's a meaning for everybody. It is a meaning for me. It is a significance for me. Or it has no significance for me. Yeah. Now, this probing, by and large, presents itself to us usually in the form of questions. Is life worth living? What's the meaning of life? From whence do we come and whither do we go? Like the wind blowing willy-nilly. What is this self that keeps bringing up all these questions? And all kinds of questions. What is this questioner? Who is this questioner? Is there really an outside agent who handles this universe only to satisfy his own whims? Now, questions of this sort belong in a particular category. They fall under the cover of what is real, what is reality. What is reality? Now, philosophers and religious people, theologians, they have their own approach, and they differ widely. Zen Buddhists, the Zenists, have their approach, which is different from that of the philosophers and from the theologians. Now, when such a question rises in you, most people try to solve the problem as it is presented to them, objectively, outwardly. They take the problem as it is asked and try to answer it in the same way that it was given. Who am I? Well, here, that sticks in the mind here, as a thought. So now this is how most people try to solve this problem. Right alongside the question. so that the problem or this question has become a thing. It has become an object. It is realized someday, sooner or later, eventually, that thoughts in the mind are objects. They have seem to have a kind of a substance to them. They're semi-material. And from a subjective point of view, they are out there. If you can see your thought, you know, you can see the thought go by, you reach for it and bring it in. Do you understand that? Okay. Now, your emotions, like your thoughts, are also objective. They are not in, they're not subjective. The subjective is what is viewing the thinking and the emotions as something opposed to itself. Now, the Zenists, realizing that thoughts and feelings are out there, they try to go to the questioner himself, the living person. The living question mark is brought into the picture. The questioner is full of life. And so the question, bringing it home, as it were, is no longer abstract. It is no longer impersonal. It is a living thing with a living questioner. It is now a very vital concern. What is the reality of me? It's quite different saying what is reality and what is the reality of me. So we have in Zen dialogues, mandos they are called, between the teacher and the student. And the student, the disciple, asks the master a question. And usually the master counters with another question. So it comes like, what is the Buddha nature? The student asks. Or, what is reality? The student asks. And the master counter questions, you know, may say, who are you? Or where did you get this question? Sometimes the master will just simply call a disciple's name. Yeah? Phil. John. And the monk will say, yes, sir. Yes, sir. You know, it wipes his mind for, you know. See? And the master may remain silent for a little while, and then he says, do you understand? And the monk looks very puzzled, you know. Do I understand what? So the master may say his name again. Lenore! Ruth! Yes. Do you understand? The monks usually look very puzzled, so the stories go, Yeah. And says, no. The master says, what a good for nothing fellow. Yeah. You know, everything, bring it home to you, bring it home to you, bring it home to you. Nothing personal is meant in it. It's just bring it home to you. You know, who are you? What is the reality of you? That you have this personal experience of who you are. Now, sometimes people have an opinion that if they are not enlightened, they're ignorant. So they have this term ignorance versus the term enlightenment. And they sit here in the mind, one opposed to the other. And it is known that often the monks will try to make the Roshi say, yes, you are enlightened. And they try, you know, they try all kinds of little tricks, you know, to prove they are not ignorant. You know. All they're proving, of course, is the deluded mind. So don't be cunning. If you want reality, be real. This ignorance, of which Zen is full of, this word, it's usually, when we come across it, we usually think of it as a state of not knowing. You know, enlightenment is out here, ignorance is out here. Ignorance is not knowing enlightenment, or, you know, whatever. Ignorance is not knowing. It sits out here. It's not being acquainted with a theory. It's not being acquainted with a particular system of thought, or it's ignorance of a law. Yeah, that's out there. Yeah. Ignorance is placed outside, out there. Outside of the questioner, outside of the subject, outside of myself. So there we have these two. This is a state of duality. We're well trained in duality. So we have now what is called abstract reality and abstract ignorance. Because you're using a word, you're abstracting from. You haven't got the concrete. You haven't got the book in your hand. It's an abstract thought. These are two elements now standing in opposition to each other. Me here and ignorance there. Me here and reality there. Now, when a cognition takes place, you glimpse something, you perceive something, you perceive something of yourself. You cognize an aspect of yourself. You may not be able to label it, but it is an aspect of yourself. It can be vast, you know. It can be minute. In the very act of cognizing, in the very act of perception, an aspect of yourself, an aspect of the reality of me, in that very act of cognition, there is ignorance. It's a very subtle point. You have to know yourself very well. You have to be extremely alert. No, I'm not yelling, wake up, be alert, be aware, observe, watch, you know, for nothing. We think when we know something, there is also something about what we think we know that we do not know. Did I say that right? Okay. There is always an unknown behind the knower. And we can't seem to get at this unknown knower. This elusive, ignorant, unknown knower. There's the place for this kind of ignorance, Look at him, This elusive, ignorant, unknown knower is the companion of every act that you do. Every act of perception, every act of feeling, every act of thinking, every act of everything. Elusive, ignorant, unknown knower. Now you can practice knowing this ignorant knower in everyday things. Look at a flower. Flower doesn't talk. They're not going to answer you anything. But in this moment, you don't talk. You just look. You cognize. But at the same time you are cognizing or perceiving the flower, also cognize the perceiver. Cognize its knowing and its ignorance. We want to know this unknown knower. Maybe it is this ignorance of this unknown knower that is enlightened. Or did you think it would be the ego? Get it where it belongs. Get it in its proper order. When this man, the Buddha, in his search for his answer to life and death, in his search for the reality of himself, when he sat in meditation, it is a foregone fact, that he was met by this ignorance, had to be, this unknown knower behind the black mask. And he couldn't for a long time get his hands on this ignorance, But he perceived it. And even at the beginning, he was that aware. And then he transcended, this dualism of knower and known. He transcended yes and no. He transcended good and evil. And this transcending then is self-realization. It is the spiritual awakening outside of logical reasoning, outside the scriptures, as they say. Ignorance is not evil, nor is it a source of evil. But when we are ignorant of ignorance, of what it means in our life, then there takes place this unending linkages of craving, desire, delusion, linked one to the other. It's like you're on a treadmill. Tanha, it is called in Sanskrit. Craving, desire. This linkage is broken. It is overcome when ignorance is understood in its proper significance. It is seen for what it is. But you have to go into yourself. You just can't sit out here bubbling around in your head, you know, like a jogger running up and down the street. Keeping silent. Now, right now, right this minute, you know, right now, just be silent. It means you can't think. Right now, when silence is, you're not thinking. The ego's quiet. Silence. Don't think. Who are you? Don't think. Yeah. When you don't think about who you are, who are you? Nobody. Big deal. When you are nobody, you don't have a name. You don't have a form. You have become disidentified from all of that. I mean, the name you have now is not your true name, is it? What is your true name? Do you have a true name? Is there such a thing as a true name? What about your form? Is this body, you're going to have it for the next 10 million years? I don't think so. What is your form? What is the form? Sitting in silence. Now, not thinking. Did you see a name? Did you hear a name? Did you see a form? Were you a man or a woman? With no thinking. Were you a Christian or a Buddhist or a Jainist? Hare Krishna? What country did you belong to? To what race? What are you? In this silence, when you sit in this silence, and it really becomes silence, you know, what do you taste? Just being. Just to be. What else does it need? Huh? Doesn't need all this stuff we put on it. The art of the setting aside the mind, or the art of ignoring the mind, the deluded mind, is the secret. Either you are, or reality is. When you are not, all is found, the totality. When you are, all is lost. Well, you're out there again with the things and the objects. Because we are, after all, man is a state of self-consciousness, ego consciousness, objectively self-conscious. We are aware of things and objects. We are aware of ourselves as a thing, as an object. This object moves around, just like all the other objects move around. We should be aware that thoughts are objects. And then you see, you become aware that you are not a thing, that you are not an object. You're not. You know, our state is objectively self-conscious state is the fall that Christianity relates so marvelously. The eating of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, this duality, good and evil, this object-subject relationship that we have with ourselves, self-conscious, objective, just conscious, subjective. You can decorate your ego. You can decorate the thinking. All sorts of achievements. And please do. Look into all kinds of systems of thought. But realize that these achievements will not give you innocence. It will not give you purity. Nor does it allow you to see this ignorance, which I found to be so important. What is this ignorance in us? It is certainly not something to run from, but something to be turned to and realized. So we have this little thing from the Dhammapada. As the fletcher whittles and makes straight his arrows, so the master directs his straying thoughts. To direct straying thoughts, first you must be able to observe them. When the content of the mind is observable, you know, these little objects are no longer so powerful. Because you have become a witness to them. And being a witness, you can use them, or you can drop them. They can be directed. Our thinking mind has been likened to a very sophisticated mechanism, you know, like a huge computer. It's a very highly evolved machine. It can be used for great things. It can be used for petty things, for little things. It has been used for great things. You know, great minds in physics and mathematics and law and science and philosophy. Yeah, man has gone to the moon using his mind. Yeah. But most people don't use their minds that way. They nitpick at each other. Yeah. You and I, how do we use our minds? Yeah. Or does it use us? Is the car driving the driver? Yeah. Do you move wherever the car leads? You know, it's now sometimes bound for a ditch, you know, or now up the mountain. You know, you got a bunch of cliffs. Are you making your arrows straight? Yeah. Look at those thoughts running around in there. Is your mind so much of a jungle that all the paths are lost? Is everything so overgrown that you don't know what's happening? If so, how are you going to stop it? How are you going to stop it? How can I stop this mind? But it's frightening to try to stop. So pile in more and more. Yeah. Maybe it'll straighten itself. Oh, I have high hopes, haven't I? Yeah. Everyone else seems to be doing so much. Everyone else seems to be achieving. Everyone else seems to be reaching. Everybody else is fulfilling their ambitions. Oh, I have to keep step, you know. How can I stop? Pile in more and pile in more. And so you go on and on with greater speed and more enthusiasm. Let's go get rich. Let's go do this. Let's go do that. Huh? You don't even know where you're going. All the paths are overgrown. It's a jungle in there. Do you know what you really want? Do you know what you really want to achieve in this life? Or are you just bumbling around? Oh, yeah, I know what I want. I want a good job. I want to have somebody around for companionship. I got to have enough food, and I got to have a good shelter, and I got to have a good car, and some entertainment. You know, comfortable living. That's what you want. Sure, that's what everybody wants. But is this the sum total of what you want? Let's say you acquire all of that. What will it change? The darkness within you remains the same. Maybe it's a little darker. What is necessary to be happy? To be alive. That should be sufficient. And that you already are. But know your aliveness. To be conscious. And that you already are. It has been said, written somewhere, bliss is our very nature. Do you know this? Oh, but this thinking, you know, it's the runner. And it runs and it runs and it runs. And it keeps dragging George. There's a joke that goes with that, and somebody can tell you that afterwards. Has to do with golf. See? The mind. Running. That is swifter than mind, you know. Run. Once upon a time, there was a sultan. And one day he called for his attendant. I'm lonesome. I need somebody to be with me, to be a companion and to talk to me. So bring me wife number 256. So this attendant ran out of the palace and he ran through the garden and he ran through the orchard and he ran up the steps of the harem. And he returned with wife number 252. Is that what I said? 256, whatever. And after a while, the king sent for this attendant again, and he said, I need a diversion. This isn't enough. Get me wife number 87. So this attendant went out of the palace and through the garden, and he ran past the orchard and he up the steps of the harem, and he returned with wife number 87. And after a while, the king wanted wife number 68, and after that, he wanted wife number 92, and so it went. But when he got to this 110, let's say, the attendant, he returned with wife number 110. He was, no jogger he, you know? And then suddenly he collapsed and died. There is a moral to that story. It is not the wives that kill you, it is the running around. I cleaned it up a little. How often does your mind sit? Just sit. Never mind all the running around. Just sit. And that's what the Zen people say, you know. Let your body relax and let your mind sit. Don't do anything. That's the most difficult thing in the world. Just sit. But once you get the knack of it, if you will persist in sitting, you will get the knack of it. Doing nothing but sitting. Relaxed body, relaxed mind with a focus. Doing this for an hour or so every day, slowly maybe, but slowly, things do begin to happen. When you first sit down, you're going to be sleepy. I mean, after all, the mind is this, no paths anywhere, so it's just going to go to sleep. And then after a while, you begin to dream. After some weeks down the road, you dream. You hallucinate. Maybe. And many thoughts will come crowding in, more than you were ever aware of before, because now you've got nothing else to do except look at them. You were always there before, but you just weren't aware. So now this mind tries all kinds of tricks. It wants your attention. And then you sit and you persist in the sitting, and then one day you're not feeling sleepy. The mind has become tired of you. It's fed up with you. No sleep, no dreams, no thoughts, and you're simply sitting. Everything's very silent. And all of a sudden, you begin to think again. Ha! Peace. I knew peace. But you can't know it until you're out of it again, because it is the thinking mind that thinks peace. Oh, baby. Poor baby. Life is hard. Nothing is easy. Anyway, take a good look at your mind. What goes on in there? There's fragments from your mother, and fragments from your father, and fragments from your uncle and from your aunt. Fragments from all over the world, you know? You've got fragments of the past. You've got fragments of the future. You've got fragments of the books you've read, the movies you've seen, the TV shows. See, really, you know, in all that, where is your own mind? Where is your own mind? Is everything borrowed? Do you have a mind? Is it just a conglomerate of all these things? One thing for sure is not borrowed. That's your consciousness. Your awareness. That came with you. It'll go with you. It is something you can depend upon. Yeah. A free man is free from both good and bad, what we call the dual throng. He's free of it. He's conscious. See? He is now conscious without being identified, because he ends their wandering, seated in the cave of the heart. He finds freedom. Okay? And now may the peace and the power that passeth all understanding hold us and keep us in the love of the Christed consciousness while we are seemingly separate one from another. And I thank you very much.
If you find Lola's talks valuable, more will be posted in weeks to come.